One, two, three, four.
I always say to young writers, you just, you know, put your heart on the page and don't worry about being like anyone else. And I would say that foremost in any of the arts is it is self-expression at its core. And I don't buy rules or a set criteria or aesthetic criteria. I don't believe in any of that. And I think the most exciting talents are kind of inexplicable. You know, you can't really understand why that art works. It just does. And that feels like it comes from a very pure place. I think that it all goes back to childhood. I was always really writing about family. I suppose we always are. I do think that it is the original wound, and it's where we are kind of wired and built from those early years. So I think every other relationship just replicates that. So it's very natural for me to go there, I suppose, because of that. The feelings are most intense there. And we just keep what the famous Freud essay, remembering, repeating, and working through. We just keep recycling these relationships and dynamics over and over again until maybe someday we can catch ourselves and try to break the bad patterns. So I think it just feels the most visceral and real to me always. You're always looking for that in writing. You want everything to be at this peak intensity, or at least I do. So that seems always like the most natural place to start.
Megan Abbott is the Edgar Award-winning author of 12 crime novels, including Beware the Woman, You Will Know Me, Give Me Your Hand, and the New York Times bestseller, The Turnout, which was also winner of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Her writing has appeared in The New York Times, The Guardian, The Paris Review, and The Wall Street Journal. Dare Me, the series she adapted from her own novel, is now streaming on Netflix. Her latest novel, El Dorado Drive, is available June 24th. Megan Abbott, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into the conversation, I believe you've selected a passage from El Dorado Drive. If you could just set it up for our listeners.
Yes, this is my new book that comes out in the U.S. at the end of June. And I chose a short section from the beginning, so you don't need to know much, just that it's about three sisters and one of their sons is graduating from high school and they're all sort of at a precipice moment. And this is the scene from the graduation party that begins the book. Everyone assembled at Pam's rental house on El Dorado Drive for the graduation party she had been planning for weeks, maybe months. Planning it like it was a wedding, a royal wedding even, and Harper half expected her nephew Patrick to arrive in a horse-drawn carriage. "Mom, you don't have to do this," Patrick kept assuring her, worrying until the last minute that he might not make that gentleman's C in trigonometry. "We can just hang out. It's cool." But Pam was the sister who planned parties, who hosted, who threw herself into everything with the sweaty fervor of a general readying her troops for the final battle, the one to win the war. It made sense when she was married to Doug, when she was president of the Junior League and chair of the Parents' Club, when she lived in a five-bedroom, six-column mansion on the canopied boulevard near the lake and hosted three or more parties a month, dinner parties, fundraisers, meet-and-greets, luncheons, receptions. But those days were gone, long gone, which was maybe why this party meant far more, why it had the weight of a coronation, the eerie desperation of D-Day. "It's beautiful," Harper told her, barely catching her sister as she flitted in and out of the house with trays, bags of ice, bug spray. "I tried," Pam said with a sigh, the back of her hand on her forehead like a soap opera actress. "I just want him to remember it forever." They both stood for a minute to take it all in, the backyard glimmering with candles and string lights, Norseman green and gold balloons, a half dozen rented tables draped with gold linen, branches strung with miniature graduation cap streamers, garlands shimmying with graduation tassels, the ancient elm tree thick with bright paper lanterns, class of 2008. More than 20 years ago, Harper and her sister had celebrated their own graduations on the grand lawn of the Hunt Club. Formal affairs that ended with all the parents drunk, their chairs tipping onto the grass, and all the kids escaping to after parties in paneled basements and rec rooms all through Grosse Pointe. Now, as the auto industry's fortunes sank, most graduation parties resembled this one, stuffed into the backyard of Pam's split-level rental house on the optimistically named El Dorado Drive, a street that would forever remain aspirational, close as it was to the shaggier St. Clair shores, a different county near the water, strange smells forever rising from the storm sewer drain. That 10-mile drain's giving everyone cancer, everyone always said. But would the people that live there even know the difference? But somehow Pam made it all work, as she always did. You never even noticed the pitted aluminum siding, the yellowing lawn, the painted-over window latches and sagging gutters. All you saw was Pam's magic.
Oh, so you really set up the scene brilliantly, and I can just see the whole theater of it. So, you know, I think I was going back now, you know, in the first interview I did for the creative process, Joyce Carol Oates told me, obviously, it's the place of childhood that exerts a powerful spell throughout our lives. And I also think of this, I always remember this line, Philip Larkin put it perhaps more to the point. He said, they fuck you up, your mom and dad. they fill you with the faults that they had. But I think you and your books have this even more expansive view. You draw the circle wider. It's those childhood friends, those sisters and mentors and the wider family that really messes us up through our lives. And I mean, if we don't navigate it correctly, it's the source of the original wound informing someone of our relationships and our mistakes. So what draws you to this emotional terrain?
Oh, boy, I think that it all goes back to childhood, of course, and family in the case. I've been so always really writing about family. I suppose we always are. I do think that it is the original wound, and it's where we are kind of wired and built from those early years. So I think every other relationship just replicates that. So it's very natural for me to go there, I suppose, because of that. The feelings are most intense there. And we just keep what the famous Freud essay, remembering, repeating, and working through. We just keep recycling these relationships and dynamics over and over again until maybe someday we can catch ourselves and try to break the bad patterns. So I think it just feels the most visceral and real to me always. You're always looking for that in writing. You want everything to be at this peak intensity, or at least I do. So that seems always like the most natural place to start. Or even if I don't start there, I end up there.
Yeah, it's wired into our subconscious, our unconscious. And of course, in El Dorado, it made me reflect a lot. That has a particular, at the heart of it, kind of pyramid scheme. And I thought a lot about it now, because in some ways, I think we're kind of in a pyramid scheme presidency. I mean, I kept on seeing this as a metaphor in an interpersonal level of what we've been with this unbelievable mountain of like merch that just say Trump has. And he previously called crypto a scam, but now he and Melania both have their own separate Bitcoin schemes and the gold painted sneakers and getting the free luxury jet from Qatar. And then there's a whole tariff scandal where we're promised that everything will be winning so much down the line that we'll get sick of winning. But for now, everything's going to cost more. So I'm just wondering, what has your examination of influence and persuasion taught you when you like train your eyes back on this moment we're living in?
Yeah, no, I thought about that a lot while writing the book, because we really are in the age of the grifter, as they keep saying. And in some ways, it's the most deeply American type, the hustler, the kind of American aspiration. And I think women and money. So I think that sort of was hovering in my head when I wrote the book, and how women persuade and convince one another of things feels particularly complex for me. I think there's so many layers to female relationships. That was really interesting to me to pursue, because in some ways it's much more veiled and sort of complex. That was sort of I tend to write about groups of women a lot, regardless of the field, but in particular the way they communicate or don't communicate or communicate without words to one another is an ongoing fascination of mine.
Yeah, exactly. And to go into how they communicate or how they don't communicate, or they communicate through a subtle, even a physical way, because, you know, they've been athletes or ballerinas, or, you know, there's a lot of kind of communication in between the lines. What did that teach me? I don't want to go into those books, which I absolutely love, but I don't want to go into them just yet. But you have at the core of this also the kind of pyramid scheme is this wheel. Maybe describe that. And how did you come across this?
Yeah, I was really surprised during the pandemic, or not surprised, I suppose, now that we're talking about the grifter era, but there was a real rise in particularly women becoming involved in multi-layer marketing schemes and pyramid schemes. There was an anxiety over money, of course, during the pandemic. So many people were out of work. And I think women have always been the largest in that arena anyway, because they often have to work from home for childcare responsibilities, etc. So they're particularly vulnerable to it. And so a lot of the ones I was reading about are selling cosmetics or new age perfumes and oils and all these things. But I was fascinated by how many of them, you weren't selling anything. It was a true pyramid scheme where, and that was the inspiration for The Wheel, which is based on a number of actual pyramid schemes where it's called a women's entrepreneur circle or club. And the women just bring money, their investment. And the idea is then you recruit more women to come next time, and eventually you will be the one who gathers everyone else's investment. So you're climbing the pyramid. And there was something so stark and laid bare about it. And the notion that how women, maybe in fact, especially because they're not selling some hokey product or Bitcoin thing, they really felt they weren't doing anything wrong. They were doing the thing that men have been doing for centuries, which is just finding the loophole. And all that stuff just I found riveting. And it was such a great way to illuminate women. Money never just means money to anybody, but I think particularly to women, how it gets really connected to security and independence and freedom and power.
Yeah, and that's so interesting. And then using those interpersonal relationships to manipulate. Yes. And those that you most care about. And I wonder, sometimes you hear, I mean, we all need money, but it seems in some ways valorized in America a little bit more, maybe in Europe, like we don't want to talk about money so much. It's embarrassing, even though it's so important. But almost like success at all costs. It almost doesn't matter how many bridges you burn, as long as you're successful or famous. That's the other currency.
Yes, it's Americans only want to talk about money, and they never talk about class, which is such a fascinating contradiction, where in Europe, you can talk about class. And I think that really speaks to the really poisonous American dream idea that anybody can, if they work hard enough, pull up their bootstraps, can be a great success. And it's such a fantasy, but we were raised in that. It's in all our movies, our music. It's sort of so in the culture. So not only is there no shame in flaunting wealth or flaunting your hustle, there's actually great pride in it. And I think particularly in these moments, which right now, which feels much like the 80s. I was just a kid in the 80s, but it was the same kind of feel, where greed is good and it comes in waves, and we're definitely in one right now. There's money that everyone needs, as you say, to pay the rent, to buy groceries, etc. But it's this aspirational desire for luxury items, etc., that have been really fueled by social media and the internet, of seeing these lives that you aspire to that are often a fantasy or a lie, but they're projections. Celebrities with all their luxury lifestyles can be quite debilitating and really hard to see for what it is.
Yeah, and then you see certain kind of funding for the arts cut or the humanities in general, because it's just not seen as a pathway to that.
Yes.
And so really at the heart of these, many of your novels are the kind of rivalries between women, particularly excavating these female psychologies and sometimes highly structured, often like physically demanding environments. We discussed like, you're revealing the dangers, the competitiveness, the power play among these groups of women. So it could be the cheerleaders in Dare Me, which you also adapted as a co-creator and showrunner for television, or the ballerinas in The Turnout. You build this pressure, the internal and the external. And for me, also, I had just binged Dare Me. It's almost this kind of dark fairy tale of young adulthood and girlhood. And particularly within those athletic dramas, like just seeing where the body itself becomes a site of drama. and they're vulnerable at the same time as they're asserting their power and finding their place in the world. What draws you to that? I didn't realize it was so cutthroat, some of these arenas.
And it truly, the very little exaggeration from the feedback I've heard from cheerleaders and from ballet dancers, even if they didn't always want to say it publicly. But I do write about athletes of one kind or another a lot. And I do think that's in large part because I have no athletic ability or the ability to dance, even though I tried a long time. And I've never felt sort of full ownership of my body in that way. And I'm so dazzled by it. And then fascinated by how women, the body is both the prison and the escape. It's the source of, you're objectified, but it's also the source of all your power as an athlete. And so that all those seeming contradictions are really fascinating to me as is competition. The conflict, which especially in team sports like cheerleading, where there's both the individual achievement and the team achievement, and they're constantly at loggerheads with one another. Because it's just such ripe, dramatic terrain, of course, but it's a perfect way of pushing, you said dark fairy tale. And yeah, that's how I think of it. It's also how I think of high school, which is everything is pitched to how it feels, not necessarily to how it is in objective reality. Everything is super intensified. And that's a way to explore all the things that girls and women aren't supposed to say or feel. They're not supposed to have unbridled ambition. They're not supposed to express aggression. They're not supposed to really express desire as a teenage girl and any kind of non-heteronormative desire at all. So all that, these areas give me the freedom to let them do all those things. So because they're in these kind of closed circuits, the team, the squad, the dance school, where you can see them all laid bare.
Yeah, it becomes a kind of claustrophobic. And it's funny because Dara and Marie from The Turnout, the ballet novel, I didn't go very far in ballet, but I remember they're sisters, okay? And I remember being like 5, 6 dance, and there were sisters who were in the same thing. And I didn't quite think about their storyline as being so dark and competitive, but I kept on wondering because their mother was a teacher, then she had gained a lot of weight. And so she couldn't dance for the life.
Oh my God.
They were her surrogates. And I just remember watching this. I just kept on thinking, she must have been like them at some stage. And now she's like this. And that was
the
drama.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Anyway,
so there's a sister thing in these, maybe dance schools. I remember looking up to them because they were about 8 years older than me.
Yeah, well, I think it does. I was taught by two sisters, twins in my case, and I do think this often, sisters, says there's a real physical body type that's preferred in ballet, at least it has been until recent years where there's been this great change in that area. But it used to be a real body type and your height, your frame, all these things. And so you do often get sisters for genetic reasons. And what you're telling, that's so interesting about the mother, because that's not only is she living out, because all ballet careers are cut short by the nature of the body, but cut short living it out through her daughters. And then they're seeing her and what their future could possibly be. And it's so complex. Those kind of that I would like to steal that for a future book if I hadn't already read the ballet novel.
Well, I think you described it beautifully. And it's always held an allure for me. I mean, not that I felt I could have achieved that because I didn't focus on it, but it is that perfection. But look at their bodies, look at how abused their feet are. Absolutely, they're swans, but underneath the surface they look maimed. So it's just that contradiction of what lies underneath the surface. Twins, there is this kind of dark sisterhood that I see recurring. It's the dark and the light sides of that. Actually is a kind of element of dance too, because a lot of the well-known ballets do have this kind of two-act structure with the dark and the light, and this one, Giselle. And I think of your other characters talking about these secrets, the light character and the one who is like burdened with secrets. I think again of like, give me your hand. And then again, that's in a kind of scientific realm. You have this ambitious and rivalry between Kit and Diane. And it's just fascinating to explore that, because that's again another world that I don't know about. I could understand it because you brought me along through telling their emotional story, that I could relate to that.
Oh, I'm glad. That was really a leap for me because I literally didn't know what their day would look like and what are they doing in the lab. They're standing at the lab bench, but what are they doing? I was really interested in that because I've had this experience a few times in my life, and most women have, where you're in a situation where you're the woman. There's only one woman. Everyone else is a man. I've been in writer's rooms like that. And in science, and especially until recent years, if you were a female scientist, you were the woman in the lab. If there's a second woman that comes along, it's immediately set up that there's only room for one woman. So you're going to be rivals whether you want to or not. And so there's something so cutthroat and frightening about it. And again, such sort of rich area to explore the nature of ambition and what it means. Can there really be only one? And what does that mean? They are like doubles of each other. I think all of us end up writing about doubles. You say light and dark. And I guess the other version of that I often think of, a lot of my books have an alpha and a beta, one who seems more powerful and one who is in the second. And then that person always wants to be the alpha. Betas always want to be alphas. So all that stuff is just endlessly rich for me. And so to have them competing in the realm of the mind, not the body, was really fun to explore.
Yeah, these rivalries. It's funny because you often are describing, because I know that you come from Michigan originally, and you're often describing like these darker undercurrents between almost the seemingly idyllic American surfaces. And it's funny because at the very beginning of El Dorado, it took me back to my childhood. I hadn't thought about it. I wrote a story about it ages ago, but it was such a weird thing because you start at the very beginning where you talk about burying something like a cookie jar. I remember my mother used to design the backgrounds of stage productions, but she also acted them. So I used to be her little line reader when I was 5 and 6 and things. It's so weird because some people have this very competitive streak. I don't really have that. But at that time, I didn't know that our neighbor girl who used to come over and I guess would be seething as she watched as I was feeding my mother the lines. And one day I looked and I had a good memory then. Because I had less things to remember. And so I memorized it. And one day I looked for the script and I couldn't find it anywhere. And she's only 5. Like, we're both only 5. And she looks at me and she says, I haven't seen it. And she said, I dug a hole and I buried it in the backyard. And the joke was on her because I had a good memory and I'd already memorized it.
It's so crazy for her to confess it. She's proud of it.
Yeah, she just couldn't wait.
She couldn't, yeah.
Eventually she could wait. But it's weird because that's the kind of thing that, like you describe, like sometimes the seed, they had a thing where you buried that, you know, but sometimes we don't recognize it if we're not inclined that way, but it can be there and it will express itself eventually.
That's right. You don't think you're in a rivalry, but you are. Because somebody is in a rivalry with you. And that story is so fascinating because it suggests, and maybe this, if she were a few years older, she wouldn't have told you, because it suggests that her desire to spite you, that her anger was bigger than her desire to somehow sabotage it and maybe take your spot or something. Because if she hadn't told you, you would have not been able to do your job. But if she needed to tell you, I think his children are so, you know, they're such beautiful monsters. And I think in some ways it's all, as I think it's especially why I write about younger people a lot, it's just all much more laid bare. I think mostly we just learn to paper over this stuff and hide these things about ourselves. I think about this a lot as a relatively competitive person. You eventually realize that it's sometimes an unfortunate aspect in yourself. It's not always for good. You know, it's sometimes it involves, what's the Oscar Wilde line about? Every time one of my friends succeeds, I fail. You don't like it about yourself and you certainly don't want anyone to know it. So you hide it, but it doesn't really go away. That stays forever.
Yeah, it is strange. And talking about the need to disclose, like that she disclosed because she wasn't a pro yet. But I think even seeing it in like serial killers or whatever, and they leave these little hints because that's, oh, look how clear. And they end up confessing because if they don't, who did it happen if nobody knows it was them?
Yes. No, it's very Freudian. I really do believe that they would need to leave some sign of it. I think you see that a lot serial killer is a good example because there's this fantasy of the kind of cold serial killer that is like a machine, but they're just more damaged versions of ourselves. They feel out of place. They don't belong, whether they're a sociopath or they can't feel the things that they're supposed to be feeling. There's a desire to be recognized. That's something that we actually all have. And I think we all reveal ourselves too. I really do believe in that sort of Freudian, like the Freudian slip, all these sort of ways that we want to be caught in some ways. You see this in interpersonal, you know, cheating spouse, etc. There is desire. In that case, not for recognition, but maybe for feeling guilty. And I think those things we don't understand about ourselves, why we're doing what we're doing, is also the area I like to pursue most, to why certain things stick with us and others don't, or why. I mean, my favorite filmmaker was David Lynch, who just passed away this year. And there's something unconsciously he understood about our dark interiors. I think that books, movies, all arts are a way for us to safely explore these dark parts of ourselves and come out not having hurt anyone or ourselves. So I always think about that. That's the art I respond to the most.
Yeah, and it's mysterious. And you talk about that deep desire, and then so often the germ of it, the seed of it, can be love, even an erotic attraction that then becomes sublimated and then becomes a competition and then becomes hatred. Or tell us, maybe through some of your different characters where you explore that whole process where the characters themselves don't know what's happening to them.
Right. Yeah. It's like, do we ever really know? But I find that, I always bring in Freud again, was fascinated by his notion of identification and desire and how they're often the same thing. But do you want to be that person or do you want to be with them or both? They're always operating all the time. And that's really one of the reasons to explore these all-female terrains, is to see how they play out, because I think the line is very hard to pinpoint. I think it really shifts in the space. Your body is in charge in many ways too. So in some ways you can tell yourself, this is about the sport, this is about the dance, when really there's so many other things going on. After the book is finished, I see it. But when I'm writing it, it's all just this sort of murky, unconscious stuff on my own part, but really how I see group female dynamics and maybe intense female friendships operating always. I don't mean your average friendship, though it can be there too, but the particularly intense ones that girls have in their teen years, there it's always a mix of identification and desire, or rivalry and longing and desire to merge in some way. And sometimes that becomes quite physical. And that just comes naturally to be. I guess it's just the glasses through which we see the world, and we're stuck with that.
Hi, this is Garrison, a student at Pomona College, where I study English. Listening to Megan Abbott speak, I was reminded of how much of adolescence lives beneath the surface, how its dramas can often be quiet and take place in whispers, glances, and in the things we bury rather than say. Whether she's writing about cheerleaders or dancers, she finds attention in the rituals of girlhood and power in the places that we're taught not to look at. Growing up, I always felt the pressure to perform. There were times I felt like I was always translating, not just across different languages, but across different selves. The quiet version of me that teachers expected, the fluent, polished version I learned to present with, and the self I hadn't quite figured out how to be. And what I love about Abbott's work is that it gives that experience a framework. It treats adolescence not as something to outgrow, but as a terrain of psychological complexity. In her stories, ambition isn't something to be ashamed of. Rivalry isn't a flaw. It's a sign that we have desires that we can get competitive for them. Her characters navigate intensely physical spaces, such as gyms and ballet studios, but what's really being tested is emotional endurance. The need to be seen, to control your image, to withhold just enough to survive. In that sense, Abbott's writing about something universal, what it means to come of age in a world that wants you to be simple and explainable, when you're anything but that. Her fiction feels like an invitation for us to ask better questions, not just of others, but of ourselves. And now, back to the interview. And you well know me, and in much of your work, we see a rich exploration of the liminal space between girlhood and womanhood. But rather than focusing on the more common innocence lost type of narrative, your portrayal often radiates power. So I wonder, what inspired you to portray this tension within the transition rather than portraying the innocence lost?
Yeah. I love the way you put that. I wouldn't have consciously thought of it that way, but I do think that is how I think about it. And I think, you know, in that case, it's a gymnast. So in some ways, that period is stretched longer, that period between girlhood and womanhood, because body has to remain small. In that era of gymnastics, still really most of gymnastics, there all the puberty is delayed because of the rigors that the body's being put through, so it gets extended. I've never really bought the innocence lost narrative, because I guess for part of what we were just talking about, Mia, where I think children are monsters in a good way, and a beautiful, like, polymorphously perverse monsters. And I suppose the only thing that's lost is the, you become more self-conscious about it as you grow older, and maybe you have to conceal it. But because Devin in that book, the girl, is in this attenuated period of deciding in some ways whether she's going to enter this other terrain or not, I think staying there as long as she can is perhaps her greatest power, as she can figure out who she is. In that case, it's a complicated experience, but I think that's so interesting, because one of the reasons I write about adolescence so much is that in-between space where every experience is a new experience, and we don't know what to be afraid of, and we put ourselves in risky situations, but then get to experience bad things, but also revelation. And that sustained period is where I think we're the most real to ourselves, I think. So that feels like a kind of power.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. It is also worth noting that the adolescent experience is divided into different aspects. So there's the social aspect, for instance, the athletic life at school. And there's also the intrafamilial dynamics that influences the experience to a great extent. And I was especially struck by how adults in your books often fail to understand teenage girls' autonomy. So what does it mean to you to center your narratives around teenage girls who are gaining power during this process, even as the adults around them seem to miss it?
No, I think about that a lot. In Dare Me, I don't have any parents in that book or siblings. And people were so, I really decided that they have no familial life for the purposes, because for them, because this in some ways is many people's teenage experience where it's like their parent, their family doesn't exist because they're so caught up in peer culture. And that's just to prove your point, how separate these spheres are. Their parents have no idea what they're doing, which was my experience of being a teenage girl. And so in some ways, it's a really important separation. I had a very happy family life, but it was completely independent of allowing me to become myself, which I wouldn't say was with my peers, but the process occurred with them. These are really interesting distinctions. In the case of You Will Know Me, because it's a real sports mom, as they call them here, she's so involved in her daughter's life by necessity. And her daughter has had to keep her parents in it. They're essentially her management. So it really disrupts that for her. She doesn't have friends. She just has teammates. Things like desire have to go somewhere, and not on purpose, but by ignorance. Her parents have exiled her from her own development. So the desire has to go into a dangerous place to express itself. No spoilers for the book, but it's a great question.
Thank you. So looking at your broader body of work, there's a strong emphasis on secrecy and, you know, in general, the dark psychological undercurrents of coming of age. Do you see this as a challenge to the noir tradition?
No, I think it's all in it. I think noir is all about secrets and furtive places and split selves and doubles. And so in some ways, I think adolescence is the ultimate noir metaphor, or noir is the metaphor for adolescence. I think they belong together.
So I was thinking, because of the psychologically charged atmosphere and characters in your novels, did you had a psychoanalysis?
Well, forever. I think I'm like 15 years in now. So,
oh, yeah. You're deep in.
I mean, just a psychotherapist, not a strict psychoanalyst, but yes. I definitely count on that. At first, I was hesitant because I thought it might disrupt my creative brain, but I've been able, I don't talk to what I'm writing about with her. I keep that separate. But for my mental stability, I need her for the sessions.
Oh, that's great. Well, I wonder, do you think that she helps you excavate something, such as to remember things that are buried that you didn't realize were there?
Yes, definitely. And that is good for writing. I mean, not that it just has to be good for writing, but the more the vivid memories that you shared, like that stuff is, of course, gold because it's in us. It's working on us all the time. And if we don't excavate it, we have no control over it. So I think having to talk every week for an hour about myself, which is really useful, it just stirs things up. Of course, you start to see patterns in your life that you want to break. And yeah, you inevitably end up talking about your childhood and you think you don't remember everything. And then turns out you remember everything.
Yeah, that stuff is printed deep, seared. It's interesting because you also wrote on The Juice. So we've had George Pelicanos.
Oh, he's the best.
Who was co-creator of that with David Simon. And also, like you, came up first through writing novels and then to writing for television and then show running. So you wrote on that show, The Juice, and then you co-created your own adaptation for television of Dare Me. So tell us about what's it like being in the room and then actually creating your own room based on your own novel.
Yeah, no, Dare Me was in development, as I call it, which just means to take forever to find out if you're going to make it for so long. And first it was going to be a movie and I had written the screenplay. And TV was the exciting new arena and moved to TV. So it was during that long process that I got offered to write on The Deuce. So it was sort of fortuitous because Dare Me wasn't greenlit yet for a TV series and we didn't know if it ever would be. But I had this opportunity to work with David Simon, George Pelicanos, and Richard Price on this prestigious HBO show, and it would be my first time in a writer's room. It was really terrifying at first because they all worked together for years, of course, on The Wire and Tremé, and they had a real way of working together. I and Lisa Lutz, who was the other female writer and the female crime novelist, in fact, that they brought on, were really both had very little experience, but they were amazing. They don't run the traditional room in many ways. You meet sporadically over 2 weeks period, then don't meet for a few months. So they would be very intense. But what they taught me the most is, because we were allowed to be on set, especially for episodes we wrote, but really we could come anytime, is what the showrunner's real job, which is being on set all the time. So you can control the tone of your show. Only you know what the tone of the scene should be. Only you know all these things that you don't think you know, but you have a vision in your head. They make their magic, their kind of dark magic. And you know, they were really very mentorly about that, and it was a great experience, and I definitely took that into Dare Me. It was a very different kind of show, obviously, but if I hadn't, I wouldn't have known how important it was to be there. I wouldn't have known how many questions get answered by people that aren't you if you're not there. And how thrilling it would be to collaborate with the called department heads, so costumes, art department, production design, cinematography, you know, how they would bring you better ideas than you ever had. And the show gets richer because of their contribution. So all that stuff was great. It was invaluable.
Yeah, and I think also for pushing the line too, because the common thread I might see is like sexuality. So exploration of sexuality, especially when you're dealing with young adults, you could see where that line might be because it's constantly changing as well.
Yes, completely. And I, you know, that show, because it was a lot about the sex workers and pornography, it was really important that I be on set and to see how set should be run during intimate scenes and how much you were asking the actor to do, because we had some intense scenes on Dare Me, and even the cheerleading scenes are intense. People can get hurt. Their bodies are being exposed. These are young actresses that have the issues every young woman has about her body. And so they really helped with my sensitivity to the actors are the most vulnerable and you need to protect them. This was before intimacy coordinators too. So I really see the value in that now.
Oh yeah, that's really a whole, I want to say industry, but we could see it's more specialized now. Before you could just kind of bring somebody in or just kind of like people maybe who are used to dealing in theater maybe had a little bit more like a rehearsal process and they could have mapped that out. It's strange if you've never acted with somebody before and the first scene is an intimate one. Another question that's really important, talking about body image, anxiety, you know, anorexia among athletes, but among young people and just like everyone, is like how social media is affecting this, how the proliferation and easy accessibility of pornography is affected. It's changed our relationship to our first understanding what intimacy is. What are your reflections of that? And yeah.
I don't have kids, but my friends who do really wrestle with all this stuff because they don't have any control really over what their kids are seeing or consuming. And that could be damaging to them in terms of their perception of themselves. And I can't imagine having grown up before social media, what it would be like to be on such permanent display. I was reading Naomi Klein's Doppelganger about this and about what, it's a great book, but we're constantly seeing this mirror version of ourselves that we've created, which is our self online. And it's about many things, but that particularly was such a chilling image because, of course, we're all online now for the most part. And if you're a novelist, you're supposed to be on social media, of course. You need to sell your books. And you start to feel this strange disconnect between the public and the private. And I do wonder how, for kids growing up now, the sense of self, if that disruption, because it's hard enough when you're young figuring that stuff out. Who am I, really? But now it seems like everything is stacked against you. And all you can hope for, I think, as a parent is to keep the lines of communication open and to try to model healthy attitudes towards our phones, et cetera. But it's never an easy time to be a teenager, but it now feels really among the hardest times.
Well, you don't have kids, but you have taught.
I taught.
I'm having these conversations with a lot of people, university level primarily. And so as you reflect back even 10 years ago, like before even Instagram, because we have the different stages of development of the internet. And now we have AI, which is now you don't know what to believe. More anxiety because you can make perfect images. So, you know, what are your reflections on that? Even looking back, the kind of analog childhoods that we could have.
Yeah. No, it's deeply upsetting. I don't think there's anything that's more upsetting to me right now. All the things to be upset about in the world, just because it feels like an existential threat to me. It's definitely a threat for a lot of people's livelihood. Thousands of professions are affected. But the existential threat is really what's reality and what's not. And that smack of authenticity, you're seeing something that's not real and you can't, it's that uncanny feeling that this is not right. And now we can tell because most of the AI is just awful and it's like slop, but eventually, of course, we won't be able to tell. And it is something I wish I could find a corner of hopefulness about it. But I will say the corner of hopefulness I feel is that, number one, it's wildly expensive. And number two, I do think people can tell right now. And maybe they're having fun with it on their own. But I think we really all do crave the touch of the real, the smack of authenticity. I think we need it as humans. And they have to believe in us as the human race that we will ultimately reject it.
Yeah, I think that particularly those who are writers or longtime readers that are antenna that way towards text, is we can identify it. But I think that perhaps those who are just like our young people growing up and AI was around since they were born, it made that ability to see the kind of authentic watermark harder. Lots of people who are the architects of AI, like Eric Schmidt, said we're underestimating its risks. He's speculated about AI being able to evade our watch by forming its own language. You don't know what that could be, a frequency or a micro dot we can't see that it right. does. Having read this, then I did ask ChatGPT about that possibility, and ChatGPT answered in a kind of logical and personable way that, oh yes, of course, what makes us human, like us, you and I, is that we're flawed and human. And I was like, but
my gosh, is that the most dystopian thing? It's chill. And I think for young people using it, I have friends who are teachers now, and I think if you never learn how to become a critical thinker or an individual thinker, that to me feels like the most dangerous in the long term, because that's, I mean, what are you going to feed into the AI beast if no one's thinking it creatively or independently anymore? But they'll still have plenty to use. To go back to where we start, everything isn't about consumption. We don't need to consume everything. We actually can create things, not just consume what's thrown at us or hovers on our phone. And I think it's really going to require a monumental fight to offset this. But it's unfortunately going to be a long road, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of these characters that you've written about, you're talking about disciplines that are physical, it's embodied intelligence, and there's so much in the nonverbal, as much as you're rooted in the written word, but even the written word is like knowing that experience of having gathered that intelligent experience from walking the earth, you know?
Yes.
And how can you read a room where you know there's all these kind of talents and different learning styles, and it can't all just, if their intelligence is not based on typing or using the AI interface, then they will somehow not be reached.
Yeah.
So that's concerning for me. But talk about, yeah, you address that really important issue of our own human intelligence, our own critical thinking, developing those skills. And having been a teacher, having had wonderful teachers and mentors, just discuss some of those that you've had along the way, how they inspired you. And even those who you didn't get a chance to meet, but you learned from through reading their books.
Yeah, I would say the common denominator for all of them, going back to my high school English teacher and certainly my parents, but extending through the writers I admire, has really been embracing your weirdness, for maybe lack of a better term. And that's the thing that makes you special. It's the thing that in some ways we can feel like we need to hide, or we need to, you know, when you start in any field or any art, you're modeling after ones that you like, but they're inevitably not you. So you are already starting to sort of stifle yourself. But, you know, every art that's worth something feels completely idiosyncratic. And I think that the teachers that I've loved have sort of encouraged me to push into my own weirdness, and that, and to challenge myself to go even further in it. And that's a great thing. And the other thing I would say, they never saw any distinction between high culture, low culture, pop culture. The only thing they didn't like was middlebrow culture. But it's so, that was also the fact, you know, because I loved gangster movies as a kid, and there was no judgment there. I loved comic books, but I was also reading Jane Eyre. There were no guilty pleasures, and that the teachers I respond to the most were the same way. And both those pieces of advice felt like great permission to be weird and to own what you like. And I think those feel like gifts for any creative person.
Oh, yeah. I love that advice. Well, so as you talk about pushing into the weirdness, and as you reflect on the importance of the arts and literature, what would you like, in closing, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
I mean, I would say that there's so many things about you that are so special and unique and beautiful, and probably the things that you think are ugliest about yourself are the most beautiful. And I always say to young writers, you just, you know, put your heart on the page and don't worry about being like anyone else. I always say to young writers, you just, you know, put your heart on the page and don't worry about being like anyone else. And I would say that foremost in any of the arts is, it is self-expression at its core. And I don't buy rules or a set criteria or aesthetic criteria. I don't believe in any of that. And I think the most exciting talents are kind of inexplicable. You know, you can't really understand why that art works. It just does. And that feels like it comes from a very pure place.
Oh, yeah. we have to express our story and not worry about who's judging it, because it's actually the most interesting aspect. Well, thank you, Megan Abbott, for pushing into your own weirdness, shining a light on female friendships, the secrets and rivalry, and for creating these flawed characters and stories that make us examine what it means to love, and for shining light on these private moments to help us understand the masks people wear, the lies they tell, and the sacrifices we make as we struggle to understand who we are and who we love. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I so appreciate it.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Garrison Xu, with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer on this episode were Sam Myers and Garrison Xu. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.